Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
American Marcella Detroit, aka Marcy, is a singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, vocalist, and producer, and has penned hits for some of the greats, including Eric Clapton, Al Jarreau, Belinda Carlisle, Chaka Khan, and more. She was a 50% member of UK band Shakespeare's Sister, being vocally featured on their mega hit Stay, which was number one on the UK charts for a record-breaking 8 weeks. She's worked with iconic artists like Aretha Franklin, Elton John, Bette Midler, Leon Russell, Bob Seger, and more. Marcy says that she's currently pretending that the music business is viable! Exclamation mark. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Marcella Detroit.
Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I'm in Los Angeles, California, considering everything that's going on in this, wow. You know, what we've been through with the fires and heavy rains and things that are going on in this country, I'm hanging in there.
Were you affected at all by any of the fires or floods or anything?
Actually, we had to evacuate one night because two fires broke out very close to us, like within a mile from us. So we just kind of looked at each other after a friend of mine texted me and said, "Did you know that there's a fire right near you?" I'm like, "What?" We turned on the news and sure enough, there it was. So we just I kind of felt like something was happening. So all day I was like preparing a little bag to take along just in case. Mm. And and we left. We went to a friend's house for a few hours till we could determine it was safe to go home.
Oh, well, yeah, it's a huge tragedy what's happened over there. Thinking of everyone that went through that, why did you choose the name Marcella Detroit as your stage name? How was that choice chosen?
Well, my real name is Marcella. I was born with that name. Okay. My parents did not give me a middle name. I guess they thought Marcella was enough. And my family name is Levy. And now I have so many names, I don't really know what to do with myself. It's like I'm married, so it's Marcella Levy - Aston, and I'm also Marcella Detroit. Detroit was chosen when I was working with Shakespeare's Sister, kind of at the suggestion of the people I was working with Shakespeare's Sister, you know, because I was more known for being a background singer. It was suggested that I think of something to kind of separate myself from that past. And not like I was ever ashamed. I mean, yeah. I sung with like the most amazing people like Aretha Franklin and Eric Clapton and, you know, yeah, Bette Midler and, I mean, tons of incredible people. So, but it was suggested and I was like, okay, yeah, sure. Why not? So we're trying to think of names and I just thought, well, Detroit, that's my biggest musical influence. So it's got to be Detroit.
Ah,
worked.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so you've referenced, let's dive all the way back. At what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you feel cool? I want to be in this creative world, creative space. And how did that journey progress?
I mean, I've always been singing and loved music at a very early age, from 5 years old. My father and I would harmonize in the car. When I started school, I would be in everything you could possibly think of, like chorus, choir, duos, trios, quartets, quintets. I mean, anything to do with music. And I started playing an instrument when I was 7, you know, when it was offered in school. The recorder was what we were all given initially. And then it was up to us to choose what we wanted to play. So I wanted to play the harp, but they said, my parents said, it's too heavy and too expensive. So I thought, well, violin. And I chose violin and I played that for 5 years. And then it was like, you know, guitar crept in. My father knew a little bit of, well, he knew ukulele. So we had a ukulele around the house, but my dad kept buying them and my mom kept sitting on them unintentionally because he'd leave them on the sofa. And so after about, I think, 4 or 5 ukuleles, there were no more ukuleles. But I had the opportunity to play them, and I had a ukulele songbook, and it was just a fascinating little instrument with just these four strings and all these amazing chords in this ukulele book that I picked out and kind of picked out the melodies because I could read since I played violin. And it was just a beautiful little instrument. And I have a few ukes now. But yeah, as far as, are you talking professionally when I decided to get into it? Well, you know, like I said, in schools, like even in high school, I was always in school plays and talent shows and things like that. And when I went to camp when I was about 13, I was in a show there. I found that music was such a great comfort to me when I was going through my teen, kind of angst-ridden teenage years. The thing that gave me the most solace was my guitar, sitting in my room and playing for like hours and coming out going, ah, I feel so much better. I went through a bad breakup when I was about 18. I was in a relationship with this guy. It turns out he was physically abusive. And I was pretty bad. One night, we had this horrible thing where I won't get into the details, but he had a scissors to my throat. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to die, and he stole my guitar. And the police came. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So one day I was sitting in this park in Detroit, and I was playing my guitar, and I remember the sun shining on me, and I was singing, and I felt so good, and I said, I looked up at the sky and I said out loud, people must have thought I was nuts, but I just said, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. And then I made it happen. I just focused. I was like a horse with blinders on, you know. It was just anything I could do to play and perform. And I put an ad on this local radio station. It was a really cool FM station called WABX in Detroit. And I just put an ad in because they had like a wanted ads thing you could put on the radio. And I just said, girl singer looking for blues band. And honestly, that's how it started. And, you know, my life changed completely.
Obviously, you got responses from that advert.
Oh, yeah. I joined my first band. And I moved away from home for the first time. And my parents, I was moving in to this house with like 10 guys. And they were all, there were a few of them that were macrobiotics. And I was living on these little cakes called Twinkies. they hated me for that. I don't know how I lived on those. But it was an adventure. And I just loved it. There were some crazy times. But wonderful times, you know, playing locally in Detroit and then graduating up to, you know, more and more different bands. And finally, I made my way into a band called Julia, which were quite big in the Detroit and Midwest. And it got to the point where we got pretty well known and just, you know, we're touring nonstop just around that area. And then we were discovered by Bob Seger's manager, and we were asked to audition to be in his band. And, but before that happened, we opened for David Bowie in Detroit.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Which was like one of the, you know, pinnacles of my career because I was such a huge Bowie fan.
Mm.
So doing that was incredible. And then we just got more and more discovered and, worked with Bob. And then it was Clapton and then on and on.
As part of the band, you were sort of performing with Bob Seger and Eric Clapton. Am I understanding correctly?
That's right. Well, not with Julia. Okay. Sorry. With Seger,
yes.
He hired Julia.
Okay.
And after several months, though, he fired the rhythm section, the bass player and the drummer. And he kept me and this guitarist and singer who was like, unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. His name is Bill Mueller. He changed his name to Blue Miller and went on to be a producer for India Arie and her musical director and produced her big breakout album. I mean, he was absolutely brilliant and a friend of mine for my entire life. Bob hired these guys from Tulsa, Oklahoma, because they were these hot shots and they were playing with this jazz artist named Phil Driscoll, and they just did the Ed Sullivan Show. And so he hired them, and that was my first kind of opportunity or experience working with these guys from Tulsa. And we did a lot of touring, but after that ended, they said, why don't you move to Tulsa? You know, because we could have our own band, and I mean, we would be the big fish in the little pond, and we could do some amazing stuff together. And I was like, well, I would seriously consider that because Leon Russell was there, and yes, he was a big influence on me. I used to have his records all over my bedroom walls, and my mother would come into my room and go, who is this guy? It looks like, you know, he looks like Rasputin or something. I'm like, Mom, he's amazing. And I go see him every time we came to Detroit. So the thought of moving to Tulsa, working with these guys from Tulsa who I became really great friends with, I just loved them. And Jamie Oldacre, the drummer, I mean, when he hit that, the drums, when he hit that snare, the first time I heard him, it was like a cannon went off. I mean, it was just like, oh, but he could also be so sensitive. He was very receptive. He was such a great, great drummer and musician. Anyway, so they invited me there, and we did just nonstop played. And that's how we got discovered by Clapton through Eric's bass player, Carl Dean Radel, who worked with Derek and the Dominoes and George Harrison. And he came to see us play, you know, J.J. Cale, Leon Russell came to see us, and I was like, oh my God, it's Leon, you know. Yeah, so, you know, we did really well, and I was discovered by Leon as well, and Jamie and I were going to go off and join a tour with Leon. And Jamie then, because of Carl inviting Eric to come to Tulsa, when Eric called Carl, and, you know, he had taken a break, I think for about a year, because he was going through some personal problems. And he called Carl and said, hey, I want to go back on the road. And Carl said, you should come to Tulsa and check these kids out, meaning us. And he did. He came to Tulsa. We were doing a gig in this famous place called Kane's Ballroom. And he came and he got up on stage with us. And next thing we knew, he was asking us all to be in his band. I had already committed to working with Leon, and there's no way I wasn't going to do that because, yes, A, Leon was to perform, to work with him was always like a dream of mine. Those girls were such an inspiration to me, and his music was such an inspiration. And not only that, but maybe it was stupid, but I was madly in love with him, and we ended up having a little relationship for a while.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So after that tour ended and my relationship with Leon, my guys, my friends who were with Eric, and they did 461 Ocean Boulevard, the album, and then they were touring the world. They called me and said, hey, come and join us down in Jamaica. We're recording There's One in Every Crowd album. So I went down there and I stayed for several days and sang on several songs. And then Eric asked me, would you like to be in the band? And I'm like, well, yeah. Tour with you? Are you kidding me? And with all my friends. And it was, I don't know, it was like a fairy tale, really. I don't know how I got so lucky. And yeah, so then I started working with them and writing with Eric and touring the world and recording. It was like a fantasy, like a dream come true, really.
So you referenced that you've been, as you said, supporting or background singer for Eric Clapton, Leon Russell, Aretha Franklin, and a bunch of the other artists. What does it mean to be a background singer?
Well, first of all, to work with people of that caliber is just, you know, people that I listened to, people that influenced me, people that shaped me as a person and my love for music. It's an honor. And to be able to be recognized as of that quality, you know, that experience, to be able to be called upon to work with them was truly an honor. But I think most background singers would say that they just, some of them might just want to be a background singer. But I know for me, I didn't always just want to be a background singer. You know, I was writing my own stuff. And when I moved to Tulsa to work with my friends, we were doing my songs. You know, I was writing constantly for me, with me in mind. I had a dream of what I wanted to do. And some of us were writing together, like the keyboard player and I, Dick Sims. I always had this vision. And I did a record with Epic Records back in 82. But it was difficult because I think once you are a background singer, it's hard to shake that image.
Yeah.
It's hard to get yourself out of that headspace and other people's impression of you. Hard to shake it. And not only that, when you're working with so many other people doing their music, it gets harder to focus on what you want to do.
Yes.
So it's something you have to be careful of and stay true to who you are. And if you can, it's not easy.
Were there certain things that you put into place to shake off that image of background singer in the industry? Or was it just a period of over time of just showing up in different iterations that allowed that to sort of fall away?
It's just my crazy determination to do it. You know, just like nuts and obsessive, truly. Well, in the 80s, and I moved from Tulsa. I was there for 5 years, and then I came here, and then I just started doing a lot of backing session work for loads of different artists, and David Foster, the producer, and that's how I worked with Aretha, and this amazing producer, Arif Mardin, who was like one of the most wonderful, kind, brilliant musician, the people I've ever had the honor to work with. Yeah, but I was determined, you know, as you do, you get management, you start working on yourself and your music. And through my managers, I got this record deal at Epic Records. And I had one of the top producers in the world at the time, John Boylan, who worked with Linda Ronstadt and had me sing on, you know, Quarter Flash albums and Johnny Lee records and loads of incredible records. And John himself was producing my record along with the head of A&R at Epic, this guy named Frank Rand, and also my guitarist, Richard Feldman. So I had these three guys really helping me, you know, do my record. And we would have thought also that John was a top executive in the company who really felt like the LA office was behind us, but the New York office just did not get it. I even had John Mellencamp's drummer came to hear us play and, we want you to tour with us. We want you to open for us. And that was a big opportunity. But the label were like, no, they didn't want to give me the support. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. And a girl got pretty disappointed. But hey, that's showbiz. You know, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You just kind of pick yourself up and brush yourself off and get ready for the next challenge.
How did the whole collaboration with Siobhan and Shakespeare's sister come to be?
I guess it was fate, but it was certainly not anything that, you know, I was looking for. Just kind of happened. My friend Richard Feldman, who I just mentioned, is a guitarist from Tulsa. I moved out to LA. He came out shortly after. We wrote songs for Clapton together. So he and I were constantly writing. Then he noticed one day, this was like late 80s, 87, 86. He noticed he was getting new neighbors. So he went over to introduce himself, only to find out it was Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics and his very pregnant wife, Siobhan Fahey of Bananarama. Richard said, hey, I'm a writer. You know, I have a studio at my house. Meanwhile, Dave was building this like state-of-the-art studio over at his house with this SSL board. It's like a $250,000 board But Richard had a good little studio and invited Siobhan over, and they started working. And after several weeks, Richard said to me, you know, I think you should come over and work with us because I think your voices would really work really well together, and you can play whatever you want, you know, play guitar, harmonica, you know, whatever you want to do. So I went over, and that was how it started. We just started experimenting and writing together. And then I was hired as a hired hand. But by the end of the first album, when we did Your History, you know, the record company and the management felt like my sound became more integral to the sound. So I was asked by everybody to be a 50% member by the time we did the second album, Hormonally Yours. So, yeah, it carried on from there. On the second album, it was just Siobhan and I started meeting at my house every day during the week at 1 p.m., working until dinner and coming up with songs, you know, for the second album.
Were you surprised by the success of it, or was it a shock surprise, or like, oh, wow, I've been putting in the hard work. This is just a combination of that.
Yeah. I mean, well, I knew Siobhan obviously was very successful, and I had a lot of experience under my belt. So I was a little surprised that it worked, because we met on, you know, certain musical levels. But Siobhan was a little different from me. She liked punk stuff and things that were a little bit more alternative, a little bit more than I did. I grew to love and appreciate that a lot more working with her. It really opened me up. I was more of a purist, you know. I was more of an R&B purist before that, working with, you know, the people I worked with. But I did love rock and roll. And so this was an opportunity to kind of, wow, what have we created here? This is so unusual. And people seemed to really, you know, very receptive to it. So by the time we did the second album, I mean, that the fact that Stay went to number one for 8 weeks, we were all completely shocked about, you know, absolutely. When we wrote it, Dave Stewart came over to my house one morning with Siobhan, and while we were in the writing stage, he's like, Marcy, you know how you always sing these beautiful ballads at our parties? Well, I've come up with an idea, and he started playing What Would Become Stay. He had the whole verse worked out, and when it got to the chorus, he didn't have anywhere to go, so I just started singing Stay With Me, Stay With Me, and then we worked on the song, and then when Siobhan and I did the demo at my little home studio, we brought it over to their house later that night, and Chris Thomas, who was producing Dave's Spiritual Cowboys album, jumped up, smacked his hand on the table, went, number one smash. We were all like, what? Really? Okay, well, we'll see. Anyway, so we just carried on. You know, we were so lucky because Dave was really good friends with George Harrison, one of my idols. So George offered us to let us use his studio in Oxford to record our album. So we went over there, and I mean, it was more than a dream come true. I mean, these things don't really happen, but it was an incredible experience to be in that place, to work in his studio. And I don't know, there was some incredible energy around there, and what an amazing place too. It used to be a monastery that he turned into his home.
Wow.
That was incredible.
Amazing.
With this brilliant studio. But yeah, it was pretty amazing.
What's coming up next for you in the next period of time?
Well, currently writing. I've released several solo albums, I'm sure you know. Yeah, my most recent one is called Gold, and I released it during the pandemic.
Yes.
Near the end of it in 2021. I wrote like 70 songs because being creative really was the only way for me to deal with what was going on outside that window. that crazy world. No, I just want to create so I can control my brain because I have quite a vivid imagination. So, yeah, I've been writing. I just started writing again for a possible new album for myself. I'm also writing with several other incredibly talented people like Jan Kloos, who introduced us to each other.
Shout out to Jan. Thank you.
Yeah, Jan. He's lovely. He's wonderful. Beautiful voice and a wonderful person.
Yes.
Really wonderful person.
Absolutely.
Super talent. So I'm working with him and I'm working with several other people, writing songs with them, but also working on my own stuff, which I'm pretty excited about. I'm trying a whole new approach. I'm just kind of trying to be more unbridled. And I'm not trying to write hits. I'm just trying to write what me, the artist, wants to write. I've been so trained, you know, not by anyone, but just by the nature of what I do and, you know, working with publishers, trying to write hits. This song will be good for so-and-so or for this or that. I'm just trying to write what I'm feeling, what I'm going through, life.
I love what you just said. So in that previous mindset of you being sort of focused to create or write a hit, if it was not a hit, would you see that as sort of a failure or not?
Not really a failure. Yeah, I remember reading that Dolly Parton, you know, she's written a lot of songs, but she says you should hear the ones that weren't a hit.
Yes.
We all have that, you know. I mean, it's part of a process. You have to write, can I swear?
Yes.
You have to write a shit song in order to write a good song, you know? I mean, like every artist that breaks through, you know, they'll have an album that'll be their breakout album. Then they'll do another album that people are like, I don't love that so much. But it's just part of the process of being an artist and being a writer. You can write a book that people love, and then you can write another one that's like, maybe not as great, doesn't move you as much, but it still has some merit.
Yeah.
It still has value. But if you consider it a failure, then I don't know. I think that can be detrimental to your creativity and even your mental health.
Absolutely. And I suppose, not referencing you, but I suppose a lot of artists, when they get or write or achieve that hit, there's always that comparison. Okay, will this be as big? Will this be similar to? Will this be as successful? And it can cause this brain chaos, so to speak, to try and emulate that all the time.
I don't think you're lucky if that happens. But yeah, I think comparisons about anything are really not very healthy.
Yeah.
They're not good for you as an artist. Yeah. But we all do it. I mean, it's part of the you know, it's part of the job description, but if you get caught up in it, I think it can really impede your growth, your experience, you as an artist. Yeah.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs. For me, it's an energy exchange to say thank you to you guys for the hard work in the creation process. I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, the listening to song from one to whatever number. And sure, if you are aware or not, physicals are a massive comeback. Vinyls in the UK last year, 5.9 million sales, the biggest since 1990. In the UK as well, CDs are skyrocketing again. So in the UK, there's a basket of products that they gauge for exchange purposes and for some sort of tax element. And there needs to be a certain amount of exchanges in order for this product to be in the basket. Vinyls have been in it for the longest time. And now because of the upsurge of CDs, CDs are back in the basket. And the research is showing it's the younger kids, the teenagers, the early 20s that are diving into this world, not the older nostalgic people. Then we also have the streaming platforms that people consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
Well, the streaming thing, I mean, that, you know, that is our modern world. That started in the 90s with, you know, mp3.com. We went to visit it when it first started. It was like this place south of LA where the whole process began, and then it was Napster. And then, I don't know, it's obviously not good for the artist, but it seemed to move us away from terrestrial radio where the artist actually got paid for their plays. I do like vinyl and I do like CDs. I think it's good that younger people want to have that experience and are embracing that. You know, I think it's good for the artist as well. It's good for the, like, the reciprocal relationship to have something physical for people to, you know, to relate to learn about, to kind of absorb exactly what went into creating this record, because it's, you know, it's not just like these songs just kind of suddenly appear on somebody's computer.
Yes.
Or, you know, in somebody's, you know, 24 track or whatever they're using these days. It's amazing what we have with technology now, but it does take a lot of work and blood and sweat and tears to create something. And I'm really glad that people are embracing that and they want the physical product. But they don't really, on the other hand, they don't really understand what it takes to create this and the amount of money it takes.
Yes.
And the amount of, you know, the amount of money it takes to let you know that you have this product to sell. This world is just like, I want it and it's got to be there. They don't understand what it all entails. It's not simple. And mainly it's about hooking up with the right people, a team, gathering a team that can help you achieve what you want to achieve. I don't think you'll ever find anybody that, you know, just kind of, it's rare. They go viral and now they're at this big, huge sensation overnight. That was all planned out. And then they have the team behind them to help sustain that.
Yes.
Marcella, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Well, I'd love to come to your part of the world, and I hope to get there one day. And please tell all your listeners in South Africa that I would love to come visit and perform there one day. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. And I'm sending my love to all of you and best wishes and peace to everyone in the world.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.